Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Author Dan Graney is a graduate of Stanford, UC Davis, and middle school teaching. He now works in outreach for Chico State University and in a variety of community, nature appreciation, and sustainability efforts. His column for the local Audubon Society, Bird Words, runs regularly in his hometown paper in Reading. He has a new book, The Worst Generation, A Myopic Prosperity. The title is an indictment by the main character of her father's generational short-sighted and selfish degradation of economic and environmental well-being. Dan Graney, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, you work in outreach for Chico State University. What does that entail?
So Chico State's regional and continuing education program has offerings in Reading. Most of them are online, but we also have a business degree that meets physically in downtown Reading. And all of those programs are set up as degree completion programs. Students go to a community college up there, typically Shasta College, and then they can finish their bachelor's degree in Reading through these outreach programs.
Well, that seems like a jump to go from, or maybe you're semi-retired from middle school teaching?
That's right. So I taught for a bunch of years in outdoor education through...
Outdoor education?
Outdoor education. The California has a pretty strong set of outdoor schools. They're for fifth or sixth graders, and they're operated by county offices of education throughout the state. And so I did that for a bunch of years in a few different places in the state. And that's great stuff. And then went on into the classroom where I mostly taught at the middle school level, English and social studies. And got into a little bit of administration, and then a few years back kind of went into working with Chico State here on, as you say, a semi-retired sort of a situation.
Well, in one point in your book, your narrator, who is a teacher, she says, fourth graders are the best age to teach. So I'm wondering, okay, is that according just to her, or maybe that's according to Dan also?
No, that's according to her. I wouldn't have anything against fourth graders. Mostly, I think teachers like the grade that they're working with. That's what I'd say from my experience in it. Everybody that isn't in middle school is terrified of bored with middle school. But those who are in it, I think usually like it.
Well, I do know that people who teach elementary age students just love that grade, and they think, oh, that's, they're just old enough that you can teach them and not so old that they get surly, maybe.
Right, right.
And I have to tell you, because I graduated early from college, graduated in the middle of the year, I taught middle school.
Oh,
for the rest
you?
Of that year, I taught 7th grade math and 8th grade science for that half a year, and they are a handful. And so I'm surprised you have the energy. You can keep up with that high energy for so many years.
That's what people do. my view of the kids that age is that they are kids and they're trying to grow up. And that's what it is. I also spent a couple of years out at Crystal Creek, which is a high school facility for court-ordered youths, boys out there. It's out in the sticks a little bit west of Reading. And there, you know, we did a lot of things. And the way things went up there, a couple of times I was out there with the kids doing some trail work. And my wife was concerned that, you know, these hoodlums might do something. It's like, they're kids. They're just, you know, if something did happen, they would try to help me as best they could, which might not be the right thing, but they'd be doing their, you know, they're just kids trying to grow up.
Well, now, if you like the outdoors, are you a kayaker?
Yes, but no. I mean, I'm not a proficient kayaker. We do have some kayaks in the garage, and we take them out on the lakes sometimes.
You know why I asked that question?
No, I'm not. I don't know.
Because your character in the book, that's one of the things that she has affection for her father because he took her kayaking.
Right, yes. And so I have enough exposure that I could use that. But that character is a much better kayaker than I am.
My guest is Dan Graney, and he has written a novel, The Worst Generation. Oh, my goodness, Dan.
I know.
And your cover, you've got smokestacks. Describe your cover.
Okay, the cover, it's got this greenish cast to it, and it's got in the background an urban grayscape with smokestacks spewing smog, and there's in the middle ground with the letters for the title in the foreground. In the middle ground, there's a little girl dressed in white holding a red heart balloon.
And it looks like she's in, I don't know if it's a nightgown or maybe it's just a dress, and she looks like she's barefoot.
Yes.
And now the main character, the narrator of your novel, is a woman, an adult.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what is her relationship to this child that's on the cover? Because when she has a child, it's a son.
Right. And a lot of the story is about the narrator in her youth.
Yes.
And her childhood. So when the publisher, you know, put this together, I was pleased with the cover selection. I did request one modification, which you see all the smog in the background
mm-hmm.
The nuclear stacks also. I think it captures, this is bad, kind of, you know, dark tone of the book. But I don't think the book really focuses on the industrial waste that mm-hmm. this shows. It focuses more on, it doesn't exclude that, but more on some of the financial abuse. And so we did get the title in worst. The S was turned into the dollar sign to try to reflect that.
I did notice that. But you know what? You talk about the dark tone of the book. And I found that this narrator I didn't find that she was really angry. At times, I felt she was more wistful. Did you think that, or am I off track?
I'm probably pleased to hear that.
because you want to like her. You want to like a main character. If you're the reader, you want to like this
person. Yes, yes. And that's actually a concern that I have. Is she likable? Because she,
I mean, you read that first, the introduction, you're like, oh my gosh.
Yes,
the introduction to the book. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why don't you read that for us, Dan?
Okay. I'll just read that first section maybe there.
Yeah.
Okay. Dear Dad, the title of this book is incomplete. I began with a torrent of ideas. Why I loathe my father. Why I love my father. Why I can't forgive my father. Those sorts of things. I'd finally settled on why I blank my father. It seemed that readers could fill in the blank with almost any feeling, and it would be true to my experience and possibly theirs too. My editor didn't like that, a title with a blank in it. So we argued around, and I offered The Worst Generation. I didn't mean it as a damnation. Maybe it's just bad luck. But with all love, I thought and still think it's true. Jennifer Allhouse.
So your book opens, and this is Dan Graney reading from his book, The Worst Generation. So that gives us a clue right there that it's not an upbeat kind of novel. But then you read what this woman writes, and yet she says, almost any feeling about her father would be true to my experience and possibly to theirs too, the reader. And I think I've got to agree with her. I've just recently been noticing all the people my age who had such a terrible relationship with their fathers. Like, my goodness, what was it with that generation? And so I, even though I don't like what she says, I think, yeah, but I think she's telling the truth.
One reason that I chose that kind of a relationship is because there so often is that
love. I loathe my father. I love my father. I can't forgive my father.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's meet. And I mentioned that she is kind of the main character, but this story is told in the first person, but she's talking to a second person.
Yes.
It's an unusual setup.
I know.
But I found it very engaging.
Good.
And I liked the conversational style of your narrator. So let's look at the very first page, chapter one. Then would you read us some of that, Dan?
Okay. You were born Dennis Arlington Self in Pullup, North Dakota in 1954, the fifth child of seven and the second son. A sister, Margaret, died of the flu when you were five, and I know from my own experience that you often imagined her as a presence in your life. She was older, so you would have used her as a confidant. At age five, you wouldn't have known her much in a conscious, memorable way, but you would have known that you were comfortable with her, that her presence meant a song or a game or a bedtime story, that she loved you and you loved her. No doubt you later embellished the relationship, put words and with them feelings to it. Certainly, you would have had cause for such imaginings. Your mother was no angel of comfort offering the vital sense of love. But embellished or not, I'm sure your sister was sweet to you. That you were old enough to know. When I asked, only when I asked, you described Margaret, Maggie, as an angel, kind and good-humored. So if you did later enhance her compassion, only imagining it as greater than that of the dogs on the farm, she was still an important character in your life. The dogs were your father's. Maggie was yours. Your family farmed wheat, Durham wheat, and it was a family project, each of you with your chores, whether driving the tractor or baking the bread or gathering eggs. Your family, with a sprinkling of similar families from South Road to Crow, from Sioux to Buffalo, and then out beyond them, far, far in every direction, with just the houses and barns and silos poking up here and there, it was all wheat, waving heads that rippled like an ocean. Your brother Jake told you that Durham was the amber waves of grain in the song. But it was Maggie who sang the song with you when she was alive and later in your memory, and it was she who made the barns and farmhouses into ships floating on those amber waves.
My guest is Dan Graney, and he is reading from his novel, The Worst Generation. And you know that very first sentence, Dan, says, you were born Dennis Self. And I'm wondering, okay, here's a guy who is so often, his daughter describes him as selfish. Was that on purpose?
That was very on purpose, yes. Yeah.
So there's a clue to the reader right there. Here's a guy who selfishness defines his character, according to his daughter.
And again, even that would be, you know, not completely. But yes, that's what she abhors in him.
And he is born in North Dakota. How did you choose North Dakota as where this guy is from?
That's a good question. How did I select North Dakota? I don't know. I don't remember that. It gave me enough of a place that I could create the world that I wanted there. I guess I've been there. In his senior years, my dad remarried after my mother had passed away, and his wife was from North Dakota, and so I had
family connection to North Dakota,
and so that let me see a little. But that must be it, you know, just kind of a subconscious thing, maybe in that particular case.
So we're meeting this woman named Jenny, and she's talking to her father. This book is written to her father. When she says you, she means her father.
Yes.
And I is Jenny. Except in the case that you have, I think it's in the second chapter, the I becomes her mother speaking.
Yes. She says at the beginning of that, and she says, you know, let me tell it as my mother might have.
Yeah.
And I did that because there is a whole lot of her. She has to imagine, you know, her parents, particularly in these cases when she's not even born yet. And so it allowed a different voice and maybe a little bit more realism to let her mother be
tell the story.
Yes.
And do you know what I found when I was reading this, Dan? That I started imagining my own parents before they had children, when they first met, because I hear stories about it. It's romantic, how they met and how he said, I'm going to marry her. He's telling his friend, he sees my mother, he says, I'm going to marry her. Oh, you can't marry her. She's already engaged to and somebody else. But he did. And so I have tried to imagine this, like you set up this scene and told their story. And I thought, gosh, I wonder what that was like when my parents met before their life. So so you sent me off on this little fantasy world of my own, Dan.
Well, good for you.
So now there's another thing I enjoyed. This is a little later on in your book. Let's skip over to like to page 116, because you mentioned somebody who's dear to the hearts of public radio listeners, and that is Garrison Keillor. And the fact that you have a little chance to expound on why somebody would want to be an English major. Because I once had my own business. I had a tennis shop. And when I was hiring a manager, I had this nice young man who had majored in business, had this other young woman who had not majored in business, but she had good communication skills. Mm-hmm. She's the one I hired. So I think sometimes college students think, oh my gosh, if I major in English, I'm unemployable. Why would I possibly want to major in English? So would you maybe you have some comment on that yourself.
Actually, I do. first, I don't mean to badmouth anybody else. I work with business students and faculty.
Yes, we have to add that because it's a very nice business student.
And I have background in outdoor science education, and my wife is a middle school science teacher right now, and I have nothing against STEM. I think that's all great. But I do think that sometimes we devalue some of the humanities.
I think I agree with you.
Or we try not to, but we lack the concept and the words to properly value them. I've heard English majors defended very poorly.
So here's your chance.
Here's my
to
chance.
Defend English majors. Okay,
right.
Would you start at the bottom of page 116 and read that?
Yeah. I know people make fun of English majors. I should say the character is an
That's
English major at this point.
Okay,
yes.
Her name is Jenny.
Yes. So I know people make fun of English majors. Thank you, Garrison Keillor. Now, there was a bright spot in your generation. Back in those years at school, I maintained that non-English majors ridicule our pursuit because they think it is easier and therefore of less value, when the truth is that easiness, which is individually variable, doesn't matter, and that the value is immense, a breadth and depth of thought and expression that the narrower studies miss. I don't particularly maintain this anymore, but I still think it's true. People might, like you, study business and learn how to rob from the poor or even the rich, but they seem not to know how to adequately feel their plight or passion, which is different from ours in being muted by inarticulation and made bleak by its vacancy of humane ethics. Or they might understand string theory, but have little sense of how to make human life richer. In contrast, the competent student of literature learns, feels the commonality of humankind, and perhaps beyond, of Wales and all the world. There is a humane and poetic insight that good literature offers. It is not foolproof and should have the benefit of science to check its tangents. But it is an insight that gives an aesthetic and moral vision that science often cannot provide until too late for positive action, and that business doesn't even look for except as a pathway to profit. It is an insight that is readily available to the masses of people, hence easy. but we have killed the poetry, the stories, and replaced them with cold and greedy formulas that may win the elementary principle's adulation, may reap the bigger profit, may inflame the righteous soldier in us, but overlooks or denies or disregards the raping of beauty.
My guest is Dan Graney, and he is reading from his book, The Worst Generation. And his narrator in the story, a woman named Jenny, is coming to the defense of English majors.
That's right.
And I so often notice, Dan, it seems that this book is your opportunity, too, to expand on topics that you feel strongly about.
I do too much of that. I know. Shame on me.
Well, we've mentioned that she has very mixed feelings about her father. And there's a point in the book where her father callously dismisses this man named Ken. And this is much later in your story. This is on page 233, Dan. And do you want to you want to set this up?
Sure.
Two people are.
Her father has been involved in finance, and this is back about 10 years ago, 8 years ago, when you know the financial crisis is hitting, and at this point, her father has his name is Dennis. He has his own business, and he's got a younger fellow working with him, and his assets have tanked, and so he's got to tell Ken that he doesn't have a job anymore. All right. You called Ken at his home. You didn't want to tell him face to face. Ken, Dennis here. Hello, Dennis, a child squalled in the background. Ken, I thought we were good, but we had bad securities I didn't know about. I didn't know they were bad. And the real estate has gone south too, and we can't liquidate now anyway. Nothing's got value. So what it amounts to is, I'm sorry, Ken, but there's no job for you to come to anymore. I'm not even sure there'll be a company for you to come to. Ken was always quick on his feet. Dennis, get me a check, a paycheck. Write it now while we're still on the phone, will you? I'll come by and pick it up. And he heard silence. What were you thinking? Were you bankrupt? Could you pay him? You could probably pay him if you did it right away before your assets were assigned. You hadn't been taken over yet, and you hadn't declared bankruptcy. You still had money in the bank. I don't think I can, you said. I'm sorry, Ken. And how I would have loved you if you had been decent. How I would have. What happened to Ken, Dad, and his wife and children? Your child was out of school. Your home was paid for. Your nest egg was many times what you and Mom needed for a very comfortable retirement. What, was your hoarding for me then? Yeah, I'd want money that ruined a family's life, wouldn't I? Thanks, Dad. And you weren't a depression child. It wasn't some reflexive action. No, it was your homegrown, well-developed selfishness. Just ugly, mean selfishness. Don't ask me to love you. Don't ask.
Now, Jenny makes a sarcastic statement there. And there's much later in the book when she says that for one of the rare times, you said Dad heard sarcasm for once. So he's not good at picking up sarcasm. She gets in a dig at him there.
Okay.
And I notice other things about that kind of give the tone of the book is that so many times where we would punctuate the end of a sentence with a question mark and use a period, things like aren't they or don't they, isn't there, and use a period.
I think people often do that in language.
Yeah, it's realistic that that's really how we speak.
Yeah.
Don't they? Or isn't there?
Right.
But you actually punctuate your sentences that way. And
I think I'm trying to reflect reality on this.
That's what makes her conversational style, makes it seem real, the fact that you do that.
Thank you.
I did wonder, too, at times. Now, you, for one thing, you chose a female narrator, so you have this told through the eyes of a woman. And there's another time when Jenny gets married, and you, the writer, describe her wedding dress. And I thought, that's interesting. Do you remember that?
Yes, I don't remember.
Her
just
husband,
where.
Well, Bill is the guy she's marrying, and he reminds Jenny, he said, the marriage is for us, the wedding is for them. Let your mom have it. Mm-hmm. In other words, we'll get married, but your family wants to plan this wedding, so let them do that. Mm-hmm. And I know when my nieces got married, my sister-in-law had the grandest time planning. They could have gotten married at the same time, but each daughter got her own wedding, mm-hmm. and my sister-in-law mm-hmm. loved that. But I did find it interesting that you described your wedding dress.
I tried to research things and be able to provide some detail, so I worked on that one.
Then she sometimes, like she mentions, her dad doesn't get sarcasm. But at one point she says, in many ways, you were a model dad. You treated me like an intelligent person. And I thought about that sentence a lot because I grew up in the age when children were seen and not heard. And my parents never asked my opinion on anything. And when she says, you treated me like an intelligent person, I thought, well, I didn't feel that from my parents. My opinion wasn't valued or asked.
Yeah. I think that is something that you and I are of the same vintage. I didn't have feelings about my parents like what Jenny has in the book here at all.
Me either.
Right. You know, our parents...
Children should be seen and not heard.
Yeah, or at least only in their own little quarters.
But she admits, she said, in some ways you're a model dad. And specifically, she appreciated his taking her kayaking.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there were things that she appreciated about her dad, that loved about her dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's real. I think... her dad as a character who might in some way embody elements of the worst generation, you know, and bring those together. Even then, he's not all bad, and. Our generation, his generation, I don't think we're all bad, but we're not all good either, and I think in creating this book, it's not how I'd want me or anyone. I don't live my life with that. Kind of, and I wouldn't want anyone to be there all the time. But I think we often decline to look at that at all, or at least only in passing. And I think that is wrong, and particularly wrong in our era when we have more power than any generation before us.
Well, I want to ask you some more about this novel that you, these characters that you have created, Dan. But we are going to take a break. And when we come back, I have some more questions for you about your novel, The Worst Generation, A Myopic Prosperity. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Dan Graney. He lives in Reading, and he is an outreach He works in outreach for Chico State University there in Reading. He is a semi-retired middle school teacher. And he has a new book, The Worst Generation. And the title is an indictment by his main character of her father's generation and what they did to our economic and environmental well-being. Now, you've created this narrator, Jenny, who is telling us, she's talking to her father, and this is a chance for you to offer some opinions on, for example, what this generation, this worst generation, did to the environment, and what do you say about that?
Yeah, it's I think I first became conscious of this idea, the worst generation, when I was down at Stanford and participating in a rally to try to get the administration to divest from fossil fuels, and you know, the whole climate change issue promises widespread terrible things for human beings, human suffering through environmental and then the economic and societal chaos that follows it. And so we were trying to get the university to make a statement, hey, you know, we've got to do something about this. And there I was with, you know, all these 20-year-olds. and there were a few other guys, older folks too. But it just hit me that, wow, you know, we're the ones who throughout our adult lives knew or should have known, you know, what was happening here regarding climate change, and we have turned the other way. We have not dealt with it in any meaningful way, and so there is still hope for us, but at least some. But that's when that idea became conscious to me, and so I don't know. I've rambled around.
I thought you were going to mention perhaps Silent Spring.
Silent.
I remember reading that when I was
sure.
young.
Wait, did you read that in high school?
Well, my first year of college.
Okay. And
for those who might not know, you might say why right. That was an influential book.
Well, certainly. I mean, that came out in '62, and that was, you know, Rachel Carson's seminal work that that started. It was directed at the issue of DDT, which was wiping out birds like crazy because it would thin their shells, and Mama would get on the nest to incubate her eggs, and they would crack underneath her. And particularly, birds that feed up higher on the food chain would accumulate more of that poison in them. And so that was a huge thing there. There's a passing reference to it in the book here, and that did result in congressional action, and as a nation within the United States, we pretty much stopped making DDT. That doesn't mean all corporate interests stopped, and it continued to be made. And I'm not sure. I think still continues. I could be wrong on that. By U.S. and multinational corporations, and just sold abroad, which, you know, again, you think about a myopic prosperity, you know, making money on putting this toxin that's going to last hundreds of years, and as Rachel Carson put it, cause a silent spring. And as we discussed earlier, I am involved in Audubon, and
yes.
And in my own experience there, it does seem, just driving up and down the valley, it does seem, where are the hawks? It seemed they were on every pole. And if you look at the stats, both the Audubon Christmas bird counts that go back over 100 years now, and then the breeding bird surveys that have gone on since the late 60s. And since the late 60s, you've seen, it varies with the species of bird in the region, but generally speaking, a 45 to 60% decline in birds. And that's not particularly DDT, but a lot of influences. And that is creating a silent spring, but we're not facing it. And then, of course, climate change totally is way, way, way bigger than that issue. Audubon's calculations at this point is that in North America, roughly 60% of our bird populations will lose at least half of their seasonal range in my children's lifetime. That's a real desolate thing in my mind. It's making the world less beautiful. When I first was working with fifth and sixth graders in outdoor schools, and I would take them out on bird walks, and we had our sets of binoculars, and I still do the same sort of thing. But what I find now is, the birds are not as obvious and evident, and I've always had the sense of, you know, how can they love something that they don't even know? And birds were a great, beautiful, interesting thing that they could know, that were accessible. And they still are, but they're not as accessible.
In fact, I find I'm often amazed at my ignorance of birds and when I was younger, because birds are fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And if you know, the more you know about birds, the more you want to know. I mean, speaking for myself, I might remind people that you actually have a newspaper column that you write for the Audubon Society that runs in the Reading newspaper.
Yeah. It's a monthly thing in the Record Searchlight. I write most of them. Other members write some of the articles also.
Well, at one point in your book, you have this sentence, "If it ain't organic, honey, it's poison."
That actually isn't referring to, at least the speaker there doesn't mean organic in the common sense. She means that it develops spontaneously. She's talking about teaching.
I want to give you a chance to talk about that, because you express an opinion through your narrator about standardized testing.
The problem that I have with standardized testing is that it tends to become the goal of education. And it tends to, that happens to the students, to the parents, to the teachers, to the administration. And I think it happens because it's a measurable thing. And we can easily put the number on it. We take a look at the number. Oh, this guy's smart. This guy's stupid. This school's good. This school's bad. And it's totally wrong. It's wrong in so many ways. First of all, just the idea that the goal is to meet that test instead of to wonder about the world. That's what we would hope for children to be thinking, to be engaged. The world, it changes, and they have an opportunity to explore it. And you just got to help them have the tools to explore it intelligently and to understand what knowing is. I came in my own teaching to the idea that my job as a teacher, and I think as a parent too, is—
Which you are.
Which I am, is to get my students as a teacher to experience themselves as lovable and capable, and the world as interesting. And if I can do that, that I would say has been a win. If they do great on the bubble test and don't have that, we're losing. And so that's my take on
education. I often think about this, in fact, that we want something quantifiable when we're admitting students to medical school. We have a cutoff point because they've made such a score on a test, so this guy gets in and this guy does not, or woman. And yet the person that doesn't get in could have these wonderful qualities that we would look for in a physician.
And a real problem there, and I don't have a solution, and I know that the universities
struggle with that.
Right, because how do you, if you're getting, 20,000 applicants for 10,000 positions, or sometimes it's more extreme than that. What do you do? And so test scores are a way of mass handling things.
You can avoid a lawsuit if you say, okay, he has point this difference above this student, and it could be minuscule, but at least it's quantifiable. It's measurable.
That's right. And it is wrong. We know even the idea of intelligence, I mean—
Of measuring it only one way.
And yeah, I mean, Gardner's multiple intelligences, I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, but his were reduced to 8 basic intelligences. And when I was teaching up at Crystal Creek with my high school, juvenile delinquents, if you will, I mean, they were sent there by the court. And I was talking with them about this. You know, there are a lot of different kinds of intelligence. You can be musically smart. You can be math smart. You can be good with words. You can be good at getting along with other people. You can be good at understanding your own moods. Of all of those, which one do you think is the one that matters the most to most people? And they were right there. It's getting along with other people. It's that interpersonal smarts. That's what matters. We don't measure that with a multiple choice test.
My guest is Dan Graney, and his book is The Worst Generation. And it gives you an opportunity to express your opinions on things like testing in schools and the way we teach our students. And you mention at one point, this narrator is talking about her husband's name is Bill, and she says, Bill is like you, Dad. He's playing by the rules he gets, whether they support decency or not. He's got his liberty. And so it sounds like that's one of the things we should be teaching. We would hope that students excel in decency.
That's what is being human about?
And she faults her father for, you play by the rules, whether it's a decent thing to do or not. A little bit earlier, you read how he just callously tells his employee, Ken, you don't have a job anymore. You're out.
Yeah.
And he didn't lose any sleep over it. I got the impression that that didn't bother him in the least.
Right. And you look beyond the book, you can't go a month nowadays without seeing another corporate scandal where it's blatant abuse, and it just keeps happening.
And then the narrator,
mm-hmm.
is faulting her father and her mother too, to some degree. And she speaks to her young son. He's just a toddler. He's very young. And she tells her son, when you are smart and handsome and rich, keep your heart too, okay?
She's developed that feeling.
Because it sounds like that's what she says her father is missing, that in some ways he can be a model father, and yet...
He seemed to have a heart, I think, when he was younger. It seems to diminish.
My guest is Dan Graney. His novel is The Worst Generation. He is an outreach. He works in outreach for Chico State University in Reading and involves himself in a variety of community, nature appreciation, and sustainability efforts. This woman, your narrator, Jenny, as described in the process of the book, described in a lot of ways. And one of the things she says about her father is, why did it take me so long to learn how boring you were?
And, why does she say that? I mean, because at that point in her life has grown. She has a child. She has interests. When she was younger, he didn't seem boring. He took her kayaking. They took trips here and there, and so it was exciting. And so I think I think he becomes boring, and her life grows.
And then that she wonders, then how could Mom love you like she did?
I'm sure she's not the only child who has felt that about her parents.
And she even, at some point says, talking about her mother. I loved you for no reason, or I loved, she's talking about her mother. I loved my mother for no reason except that she was my mother. So she has no really connection to her mother.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know if that feeling was justified on her part. You can see it, but you can see reasons not to justify it too.
So if there is a villain in the story, it's her father. But then she's saying, "But you know, my mother was, you know, not. She was just my mother."
Yeah, her mother definitely was a more back, you know, background figure. She doesn't talk about, except at least after her very young childhood, she doesn't express much of association with her mother.
Well, I would like for you to read a section in your book. There's a page in your book where she has a chance to express her opinion on the fact that the way her dad's measuring stick was finance. That's the way he measured things.
Yes, this is actually looking at. I think she treated her husband pretty poorly.
Bill, because they got off to such a nice start.
He seems like a pretty decent guy.
Yeah. We talked earlier about their wedding, and he says, "Oh, I'll let your mom do
yes,
it."
Yes, yes, okay. And he has, His job folds. He can stay with the company. He has to go back from California to New Jersey.
They're going to move him to New Jersey. She could have gone with him.
She could have, and she doesn't. And it was a very quick move. And at that time, her mother's becoming ill, and her father is not emotionally capable of taking care of mom. And so she's in a bit of an uproar. But she doesn't treat him very well, and she lets him go.
Him meaning her husband.
Yes, Bill. Thank you. So now she looks back on it. I look back on it now, and I know I wasn't very good to him. He was in touch or had been. Maybe I should have gone to New Jersey. Maybe. But I didn't want to, and he didn't work with me. I was worried about Mom and about you too, honestly. And, well, I know I didn't treat him right, but I couldn't get my head there at the time, and his heart wasn't there. He was a good employee, and they could pay him more than I could just then. They paid him money, and my love was poor at the time. Love doesn't work that way, direct deposit on the last of the month. He wouldn't have gone if they hadn't moved him. Or maybe I'd have gone if they just gave us more time for me to swallow the whole thing. Maybe I would have, but they didn't give us time.
My guest is Dan Graney, and he has just been reading from his novel, The Worst Generation. The narrator is an adult now, but mm-hmm. she describes much of it in her childhood and how she feels about her parents, and most specifically about her father. She's just now expressing her opinion about her husband, who has moved to New Jersey. She could have gone with him, but she didn't.
Yeah. I think that's one of the times where she takes maybe a little bit more responsibility and acknowledges that maybe she didn't treat him right. And she had reasons not to, but that wasn't the full story.
Well, I'd like to turn to page 267. Now, Dan, in your book, because that's where she's talking now to Jordan.
Her son,
he's too young really to understand what she's saying,
right.
But she's telling her son about his grandfather. And so I was hoping maybe you could read this section where Jennifer is her name, Jenny. Mm-hmm. Jenny is telling her son, Jordan, about his grandfather.
Okay, and so this is...
If you want to start, we're about the middle of the page. She says, Grandpa talked to us some. He used to listen, did I tell you? He played with me when I was little.
Okay, right here then.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and and they're in the hospital here. And and Grandpa too. He'll talk to us some, and he used to listen. Did I tell you? He played with me when I was little. He taught me kayaking, as I'll teach you. And he enjoyed it, too. I'm sure he did, as I will. But then, I don't know. Maybe I just got older and we didn't relate the same. He was always into his work. It was like a football game for him. Make the right moves, call the right plays, study the playbook, anticipate what the other guy is going to do. And the winner gets the trophy, the money. Maybe getting older, he just couldn't be both rich and how he used to be. Maybe you can't focus on your game, beating the other businesses, and on your family, too. I don't know. I don't know, little boy.
So this young mother is talking to her son, who couldn't understand this, but this is why earlier, Dan, I felt a sense of wistfulness mm-hmm. in this woman. That's mm-hmm. what this paragraph sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mm-hmm. sound like anger or yeah. resentment, even. It just sounds wistful.
I think I'd agree with you. I think I'd agree.
So this, she's softening. We can like her more, perhaps, here, because she's just been saying she's not going to move to New Jersey with her husband. She's
right.
just, even though he did the leaving, she pretty much left him.
Yes.
And then she's talking to her young son about his grandfather, and she's saying nice things. He used to listen, mm-hmm. and he played with me when I was little.
Yeah.
He took me kayaking, and I'm going to take you kayaking.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she's softening there.
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah.
A couple of pages over after that, it's on page 270, and you mentioned that they're in the hospital now. Her mother is quite ill. And her mother's going to die. I mean, she knows that.
Right.
But she doesn't really cry. And she says, I held Mom's hand,
mm-hmm.
and she says, Mom, thank you for giving me from yourself, for loving me in Jordan, and why don't you start reading there,
Dan? Okay. And what made me cry then was, I'm sure, her love and losing her, but also the smallness of what came to mind about her, about my mom. Yes, she had fed me, the white bread of her time. Yes, she had dressed me, always new, always laundered with a softener and machine dried with anti-static. Yes, she had taught me to use deodorant and tampons, but what else? I couldn't remember her laughing with me. She didn't inspire me to study, except as it reflected on her own social splendor. She didn't teach me to garden, even in her roses. She didn't teach me to cook or love it. She didn't teach me to care for people. She fled from her social work job. She taught me to value the biggest car, the most exclusive restaurant, the most expensive perfume, the greatest luxury. She taught me to use things, not love them. Becoming me had mostly been a process of rejecting her, or trying to.
This is Reading author Dan Graney reading from The Worst Generation. And there again, the tone seems wistful, Dan, to me.
It could be. I think it's sad in any case.
It is sad.
Yeah.
And yet she is not crying. And her mother is on her deathbed, and she...
Or if she is crying, it's not so much out of richness. It's out of the poverty of their relationship.
Yes. Yes, it is. And she admits that my mother did all the things you would hope a mother would do. She took care of me. She dressed me. She fed me. But what else? I couldn't remember her laughing with me.
Those, you know, when we were talking earlier about education and the role of a teacher to help a child feel loved and lovable and capable and to find the world as interesting, and maybe I should say, and find the world as fun, and she's expressing that she didn't get that from her mother.
In fact, I just had this conversation yesterday, a friend who lost a very close friend. She was beautiful, but she, in his opinion, felt she was unlovable. She thought her whole life she was not lovable. That is so sad.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's what is sad about this in your book. What you bring to this story, your own very background, and you get a chance to express your opinions on what we, if I say our generation, has done to the planet, to our country, the economics of our country. And I don't want to give away what happens at the end, because it's a shock. It's right at the end of your book. So we've given away some of the things, the fact that she's there in the hospital, her dad comes to the hospital, but her dad's pretty unemotional about it. I mean, he doesn't seem to be crying.
Right, right. No, and her mom is the one in the hospital at that point.
Yeah, I mean, her father just comes to visit.
Right, right.
And the daughter and the father, and she brings her grandson, their grandson. Yeah. But he's not upset.
At that point, his, I think younger, you see more liveliness in him and engagement with the world. But I think his world has grown smaller and smaller. And at
he
that point,
he closes himself off by putting clothing, covering his ears and listening to something else.
Yeah. And it's a less lively world for him. And his sense of his relationship with his dying wife at that point is, you know, I'm going to keep her heart going.
Yes. And you just think, oh, no, please don't keep torturing her, because she has cancer and they're treating her with chemotherapy. And he says, yeah, just keep those machines.
Right.
Keep her alive.
Right.
And then when he finally decides, OK, that's enough. Why? What was his motivation?
Yeah. At that point, in his work, his insurance had changed. And so the insurance wouldn't pay to keep her on the machine anymore.
And then it makes it hard to like that person like that, who says, okay, keep her alive as long as the insurance is paying. When the insurance is no, that's enough, we're not paying anymore. He says, okay, unplug her.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think my reaction, and certainly Jenny's in the story, is kind of appalled at that concept of keeping her alive well before he gets to that.
Yes, before that, we're shocked by that.
Yeah,
that whole idea, just keep her alive. They can do it. They just add another machine and keep her heart going
her
breathing.
There is no life there, really.
No, there is no life. No. I mean, Jenny feels her mother is already deceased.
Yes.
Because she's just there.
Right, right.
Well, I enjoyed reading your book. It's not exactly upbeat.
It's not. I don't know if it's enjoyable.
I did, though, because I found it thought-provoking.
Thank you.
I think it challenges us to make some changes in our approach to do what we can do. And you don't beat us over the head with saying, why don't we make some changes here? But yet, I think you inspire us to say, maybe we should take another look at this.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dan Graney. His novel is The Worst Generation, A Myopic Prosperity. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.